From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Palestinians buried their dead today after dozens died in clashes with Israeli troops on the Gaza border yesterday. It was the single deadliest day there since 2014, and it coincided with the celebrations at the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. The BBC's Nida Ibrahim joins us from Gaza on her cell phone. Nida, describe what you've seen there today.
We came to the same scene that was the deadliest scene in Gaza yesterday. But we were surprised today that the number of protesters here has radically decreased. Not many Palestinians have turned up. Of course, this has many reasons. Some are saying that some of them were in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip, actually laying their beloved ones to rest after 60 people were killed yesterday. But there's another reason that people at our sources are talking about, which is the fact that Egypt has mediated a deal between Israel and Hamas to kind of de-escalate the situation on the ground in exchange for relaxing the situation when it comes to the borders and the siege that Gaza is living under for the past 11 years.
What do you mean relaxing? What are they doing?
They are trying to open the borders a bit more. As you know, there are many borders connecting Gaza with Israel as well as Egypt. But these borders have been closed most of the time and under strict restrictions. And Gaza's only our main access to the outer world is through Egypt. But that border is closed most of the year. So they are trying to reach a deal that kind of would allow people as well as goods in and out of the Gaza Strip, in addition to opening or releasing the fishermen's area. You know, they're only allowed to go a certain amount inside the sea. So they are being given, or they would be, according to our sources, information of what the deal would entail, that would allow fishermen to go inside the sea a little bit more.
Now, Israel is saying that it was responding yesterday to attacks from Hamas. What is Hamas saying about that today?
So Hamas has not been talking much about what's happening on the ground. But from our observation, we were covering at the one of the main confrontation points between protesters and the Israeli forces. And we have not seen much of military acts by the protesters here on the ground. However, today we saw protesters trying to shoot down a drone that was coming from the Israeli side that was filled with tear gas bombs. So we've seen some sort of bullets here and there trying to shoot it down, but it's really hard to confirm if there has been attacks. Some people here are saying that this might be an Israeli claim to justify or explain the killing of so many people. We've heard protest organizers talk about a disproportionate use of fire. Now, as we're speaking, I'm seeing many people running away from the fence area. It seems that the drone that's filled with tear gas is back again. Yes, indeed, it is. And it just shot down volleys of tear gas bombs. It's actually, I can see somebody being hit, but you know, he actually managed to escape it.
Is it your sense that these demonstrations that we've seen are about the embassy move by the United States to Jerusalem, or that this has more to do with the 70th anniversary of the displacement of Palestinians when Israel was created?
So it's, as one Palestinian protester told me yesterday, it's kind of adding insult to the injury. The embassy move has definitely aggregated feelings and made people feel even more frustrated with the peace process that has been going on for over two decades without any hope.
That's the BBC's Nida Ibrahim joining us from Gaza. Nida, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Question. Whatever happened to the once ballyhooed investigation by the Education Department into for-profit colleges? Well, according to a report in the New York Times, the special team created at the end of the Obama administration to investigate questionable loans and job promises made by many for-profit colleges has been marginalized or told to focus on something else. And Secretary Betsy DeVos has given oversight of the team to Julian Schmoak, a former dean at the for-profit DeVry University, which has paid out settlements for fraud. Schmoak is now one of several former for-profit executives now in the Education Department. For a check-in on for-profit colleges, we've got Goldie Blumenstick, a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education and author of the book American Higher Education in Crisis. And Goldie, the Times is reporting that this team and the scaling back of it has effectively killed investigations into fraudulent activities at these schools. How would you characterize what's going on with the investigations and the team?
What's been happening with the investigative unit is actually fits more broadly with what the department has been doing overall, which has been a very decided shift from the direction that was taken under the Obama administration. The Obama administration had sort of a laser-like focus maybe on for-profit colleges and also on student loan concerns, whether students were being treated well by student loan companies. And this administration has taken sort of an opposite point of view. It's not been making that as high a priority. I think people were expecting this unit to sort of be unwound over time as soon as Secretary DeVos was nominated and the Trump administration came in. There still is a theory of enforcement at the department, but it doesn't have sort of that focus that it used to have.
Well, and the Education Department insists that oversight of for-profits continues, that Schmoke and some of the other former for-profit leaders who are now working at the Education Department don't have conflicts of interest. But how would you characterize the need for investigations? How would you characterize the current state of the for-profit college universe?
Well, I mean, they say, by the way, that they haven't scaled it back, but we actually haven't seen any evidence of any investigations in the past year and a half. It may be that there's been nothing that needs investigating, or it may be that the department has scaled back its focus on these kinds of investigations. And to be sure, the for-profit industry, I wouldn't say it's a shadow of its former self, but it is not the roaring tiger that it was a few years ago. Many of the biggest publicly traded companies are gone, ones that you might have remember hearing about, Corinthian, ITT. Others like Career Education Corporation is a much smaller company than it used to be. Enrollments are down at a lot of those places. Kaplan, one of the for-profit colleges, wasn't one that was heavily investigated by the Education Department, but it's recently been acquired by Purdue University. So there's been kind of a broad shift in the whole sector.
Well, you mentioned Purdue University. It's one thing for Purdue to pick up what used to be a for-profit, Kaplan, and turn it into a nonprofit. We know Purdue, the research university in Indiana, it has credibility. But we're looking at, for instance, DeVry. In 2016, it settled with the FTC, paying $100 million to end a lawsuit that claimed it misled prospective students about jobs and salaries after graduation. And then in 2016, DeVry reached a limited settlement with the Education Department because it couldn't back up claims that 90% of graduates got jobs in their field within 6 months. Now, DeVry is known as Ad Talum Global Education. It's still doing business.
Right. Well, DeVry, the company, has changed its name. DeVry, the university, is slated to be sold again to another company, to a company called Cogswell Education, which is owned by a private investor. So the DeVry University that we used to see heavily advertising on TV and it's had a lot of enrollment declines over the past few years, this sale is now pending, depending on whether the Education Department approves it.
Well, back in December of 2016, you wrote about the Trump transition team's initial meetings on education. One was with Jerry Falwell Jr., who runs the Christian-focused Liberty University. You said this signaled an open door to new approaches. What else are you seeing? What are you looking at within the Education Department?
Well, we've just recently seen the Education Department announce plans to basically re-regulate a whole host of areas of education that the former Obama administration had regulated. They're going to be looking at things like what constitutes a credit hour. And that sounds really geeky, but it really means, how do they award financial aid and for what kind of services? Do you have to really sit in a class, or can you receive federal financial aid for sort of a different form of education? They've also talked about rethinking, what does it mean to have regular and substantial contact with your instructor? If they sort of change that definition, it could open the door to a lot of what some people might call innovative education models and what others might call questionable education models. But certainly it could open the door to more education models that are based around competency education. That involves, you know, basically awarding credits based on students demonstrating that they've mastered the subject matter, whether it took them a week or whether it took them, you know, 4 years.
Oh, and what are the questions that raises?
There's probably some 600 colleges right now, most of them not-for-profit, most of them traditional colleges, that want to experiment with this model. So that's not one of those things that's necessarily a fly-by-night approach. It is an innovative model. It is one of the things that the department has said it might be more willing to consider under the DeVos administration. There's just basically been a complete shift in direction from the DeVos administration, from the Obama administration. The Obama administration was very focused on regulation, what members of Congress call sort of guardrails, making sure that programs didn't charge too much relative to the kind of salary a person might earn later. The DeVos department has not been as interested in that. There's a rule that's been sort of governing that called the gainful employment rule. The DeVos department has recently had sessions to talk about a new way to rewrite that rule. They've done the same with rules to protect borrowers who feel like their colleges have cheated them and leaving hurts of thousands of students actually in the lurch right now as to whether or not they're going to be able to get their loans forgiven.
But the Times is reporting that the mission of that, remember the special team we were talking about, we started off with it, that was supposed to investigate for-profits. It's now been scaled back to focusing on processing student loan forgiveness applications.
To the degree that the department might be focusing on those pending applications, that's probably good news for those students affected. There won't be a large strike task force, you know, with broad experience that goes beyond student loan processing, looking more broadly at the sector.
That's Goldie Blumenstick, reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, author of the book American Higher Education in Crisis. Goldie, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been reporting on the explosion of opioid addiction, but also the accompanying clean needle exchange centers to help curb diseases like HIV and hepatitis. We've heard from a researcher who says needle exchanges, where addicts can turn in their used dirty needles for clean ones, definitely lower the rate of disease. Las Vegas has started using needle exchange vending machines. But some cities are shutting programs down. Charleston, West Virginia Mayor Danny Jones says his city's Kanawha County Exchange Program drew too many people. And despite being a recovering alcoholic and the father of a heroin addict, he wants it closed. Mayor Jones joins us. And Mr. Mayor, yesterday we heard from Ricky Bluthenthal, a professor of preventative medicine at the University of Southern California. He said the research is conclusive that needle exchanges work. What are you seeing?
Well, it became we have two needle exchanges in Charleston. One is operated by HealthRight, and they have 150 patients, and it's operated in a fashion that is correct. And they did so well, they operated under the radar. We didn't even know they were doing it. Then the Kanawha Charleston Health Department got in the business, and they just basically became a mill. And they were giving out 40,000 to 50,000 needles in a month. Now, if you go through 400 patients in one day, then there's no way you can check their blood before you give them the needles to find out if they have any disease before you give them the needles.
Well, but the health advocates who are backing this, first of all, they said they didn't expect, you know, this huge explosion, and it speaks to just how bad this crisis is. But you're right. They had 483 drug users pass through in just 8 hours one day. This is, you know, you only got, what, 50,000 people there. And they say that speaks to the need for people coming in to get these clean needles.
Well, except they came from 190 different zip codes, and we became a hub of activity. Now, to get the money to buy the drugs, the drug users have to break into somebody's car or cause crimes. Since we became a mecca for these folks, It wasn't a needle exchange, it was a needle mill, and crime in this city skyrocketed. So what we did was we imposed some rules on them that they had to live with that were very similar to the HealthRight rules. They couldn't live with them, they shut it down, and now the crime has gone way down in Charleston, West Virginia, because we were able to close that needle operation.
Well, let's talk about what your rules were. An ID requirement? So that people who were coming to get these clean needles had to prove that they lived in the county, picture ID. They had to be tested for hepatitis and HIV. That would be mandatory. Needles would only be dispensed on a strict one-for-one trade so that there wouldn't be any extras that people could maybe sell. But you all know that, you know, advocates, healthcare advocates, say that the ID in particular was prohibitive. Homeless people make up a huge population of these addicts. They don't have IDs. And the idea of limiting the clean needles, you know, means that maybe somebody can't give a clean needle to somebody who might need it. So you've got maybe another dirty needle being used. But I hear your point as well, that this was not only attracting this population, but it was in a place where you had just built a beautiful civic center, a $100 million development, and you hope to revitalize the city through that.
And this health department was just, it's a half a block away. The Civic Center hadn't been finished yet, but it became basically a mini mall for drugs. And if the drug dealers knew when the needles were going to be dispensed, when they were going to be given out, and that was all day on Wednesday, then the drug dealers were waiting in the shadows, and they were all through the neighborhood to sell drugs to the people that needed the drugs to put in the needles, that they just had to break into somebody's car to get the money to pay the drug dealer.
Well, what about the fact that this center would be, for many of these addicts, their only contact with healthcare? So that the thinking is, in addition to luring them in for the clean needles, they might also be able to talk to healthcare officials. They might get tested. They might maybe even get information about getting clean.
That's not what happened here. They only had a 1% rate of people going into recovery, where HealthRight, which is the one that I actually contribute my own personal money to, and they have a needle exchange, they have more like a 10% return rate on people that go into recovery. Mm-hmm. You see, when we have such an uptick in crime because of this needle situation in our city, they don't call some professor in Southern California. Mm-hmm. They call us. Since we shut down the Kanawha Charleston Health Department, or since they shut down their own needle operation, crime has dropped precipitously.
But what happens to the addicts?
Perhaps they went back to wherever they came from, maybe one of those 190 zip codes, or they could go down to HealthRight, where the entrance is a little more cumbersome, but they would be more likely to get into recovery, and they would be tested for disease before they go in. I don't know how you can quantify whether a person has hep C if you don't test them for it before you give them the needles.
Well, a couple things. A lot of bruised feelings in your city. There are people who feel that they were removed from certain committees because they weren't going to vote the right way. There are police and fire officers who are feeling like they aren't respected by the healthcare people because, as you said, there are concerns about the needles that are still around. You are retiring, and it feels like leaving a lot of bruised feelings behind.
I'm on the side of the policemen and the firefighters, and it's not
just health department.
It's from city council members, and some people that are members of the board of the health department. One of which is a council member and is a leading advocate for this. The doctor that started all this is no longer there. Mm-hmm. He became drug czar for the state. We're for Charleston, and we're going to advocate for it. And we would suggest that anybody that wants to be involved in a needle exchange go down to HealthRight. They have 25,000 patients there.
Well, I hear what you're saying. Is one solution to encourage other counties, other zip codes, to also have maybe smaller needle exchanges? In other words, have more of them. Don't put them next to a gleaming, you know, civic center that understandably is supposed to draw tourists and business to the area. Have smaller ones, but more of them outside the city?
You know, I'm sure you can find many academics that think this is a good idea, but it certainly didn't work out there near Angel Stadium in Southern California. And there are places they're shutting down around the country, and I wouldn't recommend it to anybody.
Well, you had a son who had a heroin problem, so obviously you care about this issue.
Of course I care.
So what can be done? I mean, clean needles are valuable.
If you really want to know, I mean, the drug companies got us into this mess when they flooded this state of all states with millions of these pills. So then they shut the pill mills down. They put the doctors in jail. They shut down the drug stores. And there was no plan B for the drug addicts. And that expense and whatever needs to be done for these folks should be incurred and paid for by the people that caused it. And if that meant that you would have prescribed drugs to wean people off that was administered by a hospital, that's something worthy of having a conversation about.
That's what you want, prescription heroin? For instance.
I would look at it. Yeah. I mean, I think that's something, if we're going to have a conversation about something, I mean, that's something that would open up a dialogue about something reasonable. Don't just give them the vessel and let them have to go out and buy it illegally. I mean, this should be handled by professionals. And if the academics really want to push something, maybe this could be experimented with around the country.
Yeah. How did your son? I mean, heroin's vicious. How did he?
Yeah, he was. I believe it started, without exposing myself to liability here, it started in his home, in the environment he was raised in, and it wasn't by me. I was not married to his mother, and in the environment where he was born in, drugs were readily available. And he told me later on that he started using drugs at a very early age. And then he had teeth problems, and he was able to get some pain medication. Mm. And I think he was off to the races then.
How did he stop?
Well, he stopped because he kept going to jail. I had him arrested twice. I have 160 police officers that work for me. And the last time, though, it wasn't police in this county. It was police in another county. And this is the third time he's been in front of a judge to plead guilty. But he's in recovery now, and he is, as I understand, he's doing okay. He's 28 years old. But you reach a point as a father of an addict, you can't let your whole world become a set of dominoes because you have a son. Life goes on for all of us. And I'll tell you, jail saved his life, which is sad.
And even though you wouldn't want your son to contract these diseases like HIV or hepatitis, you—
I don't know that he hasn't, Robin.
Well, but—
I don't know that he—I don't know if he has or not.
But a clean needle—
I'm not willing to sacrifice a whole city to get involved in that enterprise. There's no way to tackle this. You don't sacrifice a whole city over this.
That's Danny Jones, mayor of Charleston, West Virginia. Boy, it's just your whole story is so telling of the reach of this crisis. Thanks, Mr. Mayor, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
So, there were two needle exchanges in Charleston, one the nonprofit HealthRight, one the Kanawha County Health Department. We just suspended. A spokesperson told us that of the 4,000 clients they served, more than 150 sought recovery, which is just less than 4%, not the 1% that the mayor said. And the spokesperson also said there was screening for hepatitis C and HIV. Yesterday, Seattle City Council approved a new corporate head tax to help address its growing homelessness problem, created in part by large corporations like Amazon. But the final version of the so-called Amazon tax was much smaller than the initial proposal after Amazon made some threats. And still, Amazon's not happy. Here to explain our weekly guide to the world of tech Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor of Recode. Ed, remind us, how does this tax work and how much smaller is it than the initial proposal?
So critics called this, or at least people in favor of Amazon called it the Amazon tax. The tax is basically proposed at $500 for every employee you have in the location in Seattle. And Amazon employs about 45,000 people locally, so the tax bill could have been relatively high for them.
Well, and this is for all large corporations, but Amazon, of course, is the big one. This is their home.
Right.
And Amazon made some threats. They halted two major expansion projects in Seattle to protest that $500 a head. And so what is it now?
So the compromise is now it's down to $275 a head. So there's still this this head tax. And Amazon, even though they were planning to sort of expand into about 7,000 or 10,000 new jobs, new positions with the expansion of these buildings, they're going to go ahead with some of that. But they're still thinking about, well, maybe not expanding as much as we originally thought because of this tax. The other context, though, is that Amazon profits $3 billion annually.
Yeah.
So this tax probably would not have been a huge weight on them. But of course, they still push back on it.
Well, look, and other cities are looking to woo Amazon in that contest. They're sort of having to see where they also expand. How are other cities going to feel about, hey, Amazon, twisting some arms to get a law reduced?
Yeah, certainly some of these other cities that are kind of vying for the second headquarters, some of them reacted negatively to it. They don't like that sort of idea of, well, if you're going to come in and participate in the community, that this is how you do it, instead of just pushing back and not wanting to help out with the local crises. The housing crisis is really everywhere now. It's mm-hmm. not just about lack of housing. It's lack of affordable housing. And that's what the Seattle tax was really about.
Yeah. I mean, there's just the Amazon has driven up the cost of housing and also filled too much of the housing so people have been out on the streets. Look, by the way, when will we know about Amazon city selection?
It's not for another few months, I think, at this point. They're going back and forth on it. And, you know, I think they're still waiting to get a bit more information from the other candidates, but it seems like they're getting closer and closer to it. My bet is somewhere on the Northeast. I think that's sort of where they're kind of thinking in terms of where their needs are, distribution needs. The other possibility would be
Boston,
Midwest.
Sort of where we're
Boston,
based.
Newark is a possibility. Yeah. Newark offered a lot of tax incentives, probably too much, some argue. Well, Dallas is a distinct possibility. Well.
That's at the base of this, taxes. Look, you broke the story yesterday, just have less than a minute, that Amazon's going to move to increase diversity on its board, but it initially opposed that as well. So what's going on, real quick?
So, you know, this is a shareholder proposal, actually, and that Amazon pushed back against. They're saying, well, we already do this. We don't need a formal policy. A lot of employees internally pushed for it. They said, why aren't we doing this? And we reported on it. And after that, the outcry around that, they responded, fine, we'll formalize this process. We'll make sure we look at set of diverse candidates for board seats as they open up. So now it's real. Now it's formal.
A little arm twisting back at Amazon. Ed Lee, managing editor of Recode. Thank you.
Anytime.
The UN Human Rights Commissioner today condemned what he called appalling violence in Gaza, where Israeli soldiers opened fire on protesters, killing 60 Palestinians and wounding thousands more. The protests coincided with the U.S. moving its embassy to Jerusalem. Joining us now to talk about that and more is Leon Panetta, who was CIA director and secretary of defense under President Obama. Secretary Panetta, welcome back.
Nice to be with you, Jeremy.
And I want to start with Israel and listen to a clip here from David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, who was on NPR this week and said this.
What the president did when he made this decision was to remove from the Palestinians the right to veto the recognition by the United States and other countries of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
Do you think that the U.S. can now still be an honest broker in the conflict?
I find it very difficult to see how the United States could now be an honest broker, because the status of Jerusalem was always one of those issues that would be resolved between the Israelis and the Palestinians through negotiations. And now, having removed that issue and basically given that issue to the Israelis, it's going to be very difficult for the United States to now be any kind of credible arbiter when it comes to trying to resolve the Middle East peace situation.
What about the fact, though, that this was a policy of a number of administrations, including ones that you served in, to move the embassy to Jerusalem, and the Trump administration is just doing what everyone else said they would do?
Well, everyone obviously made that statement, but also the fact was we would support such a move only if it was part and parcel of an overall agreement for peace in the Middle East. I mean, that should still remain the goal. This isn't a question of just having the United States do whatever it wants to do. It's a question of whether or not we can get the Israelis and the Palestinians to come together and find peace in the Middle East. That objective is now farther away than ever.
What would be your next step if you were in this administration?
Well, this administration has made it very difficult now to try to establish some credible ties to all of the parties that would have to be at the table. I would think that the objective here would be to appoint some kind of negotiator who has credibility on both sides. I'm not sure I see that kind of negotiator right now, but I think Secretary Pompeo is somebody who I think has the capability of perhaps identifying somebody who could kind of restore the credibility that's needed in order to bring the parties together.
Let me ask you about North Korea. What are your expectations for the upcoming meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un? Do you think this is going to be finally it? I mean, we've been kind of close to this point before, but never quite here.
Well, Jeremy, we have seen over 60 years of periods of provocation and periods of accommodation with the North Koreans. The bottom line from all of that experience is don't trust the North Koreans, particularly now, because obviously the main goal of the Kim family, including Kim Jong-un, is to preserve the regime. That's what they're after. And the reason they developed their nuclear weapons is in order to protect the regime. So I find it difficult to believe that they're just going to walk in and totally denuclearize and move in that direction. I think we're looking at probably a meeting that will in many ways be a photo op, having the president and Kim Jong-un sit down, agree to some kind of broad framework, and then allow the negotiators from all the parties to be able to sit down and really work out the details. If it proceeds along those lines, then there's some hope, perhaps, that some kind of negotiated resolution could be achieved.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Leon Panetta, the former Secretary of Defense, former CIA director, former White House Chief of Staff. And let me ask you about Iraq. They just had an election. The winner appears to be the nationalist cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose followers have launched attacks on American and coalition troops in the past. What do you make of his success in this election?
Well, Iraq has always, in many ways, been a disappointment in the sense that, you know, for all of the sacrifices that have been made in Iraq, the hope was we could develop an Iraq that could govern and secure itself. And time and time again, that dream has collapsed. And, you know, we thought as a result of the defeat of ISIS that we might be on a better path. But the election of Sadr tells me that we are probably going to be in for an additional difficult period here. Doesn't mean we should walk away. I think we need to continue to press Iraq to move in the right direction and to try to govern itself. But it's going to be particularly difficult because of the different tribal differences that have always divided that country.
And what about Afghanistan? As a candidate, President Trump called the war there a complete waste, but he's actually deployed more troops. And there was a recent report that said the number of Afghan troops is shrinking. And we know that Taliban and ISIS attacks are up. What should the U.S. strategy in Afghanistan be?
Well, first and foremost, to have a strategy. My concern right now is that, you know, we're continuing to put our troops in place, but I'm not sure what the overall strategy is. You know, it seems to me that it would be important to develop a strategic plan that says we are going to try to go after particular areas in Afghanistan and try to secure them on some kind of coordinated basis, working with the Afghans. The way it is now, we're doing this a little haphazard, hit and miss, and frankly, ISIS and the Taliban have the better hand here, and they're continuing to use it in killing Afghans. So it just seems to me that if we're going to be there, and I do believe we have a responsibility, again, to that country to hopefully develop a nation that can secure and defend itself and govern itself. But if that's going to happen, you need to have some kind of comprehensive strategy that's very different from what we're doing now.
I want to ask you about one more thing. The Washington Post reported last week that the Trump administration appears to have scrubbed the mention of climate change from a major Defense Department report that was first drafted in 2016. When you were Secretary of Defense, you said climate change could have a dramatic impact on national security. How worried are you about this, and how big a threat is climate change compared to all the other things that we've been talking about?
Well, the purpose of the Defense Department and the planning by the Pentagon is to consider all potential threats to our national security, whether it's military or economic or social or political or natural. When I was secretary, also when I was director of the CIA, we established offices that represented the threat that could be produced by climate change through rising seas, through droughts, to floods, to severe weather, to impacts on our national defense structure itself. And we've recognized that. General Mattis has recognized that is a legitimate concern that should be considered. The most important thing, you know, with regards to defense planning is that we should not deal with the world as we would like it to be. We have to deal with the world as it is, and that includes climate change.
You mentioned Secretary Mattis. Do you think he's going to last in the administration, given that he was on the other side of the president on the issue of the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, he's in a lonely position right now because he did have additional support on the National Security Council with Secretary Tillerson and with General McMaster. But, you know, knowing Jim Mattis, he's not somebody who's going to walk away from his responsibility. And very frankly, I would rather have him there in the room than walking away and allowing others to make decisions with regards to war and peace by themselves. And I hope that he continues to present his views as clearly and definitively as possible.
That's Leon Panetta, the chairman of the Panetta Institute, also former Secretary of Defense and CIA Director under President Obama. Secretary Panetta, thanks as always.
Good to talk to you, Jeremy.
Up to 50 million Americans have some kind of hearing loss, and only a fraction of them, about 14%, use hearing aids. One big reason, the cost. Here now's Peter O'Dowd reports.
It was a case of hearing aid sticker shock for Betty Houck.
The ones that I have, they actually cost $5,600.
A lot of money for a 72-year-old retired musician whose journey with hearing loss we've been following. And your insurance doesn't really cover it.
No, I'm not, that was another shock.
But Houck was lucky. The former violist who once played in a string quartet with Yo-Yo Ma had family members who picked up the tab.
It was an incredible gift. When I went to see the audiologist to get the hearing aids, she got kind of teary and she said, "Oh, that's so touching." And she knocked like $600 off. So they were $5,000 instead of $5,600.
A price tag like that is often a surprise to people buying hearing aids for the first time. Sophisticated electronics is one reason they're so expensive. But it's not the only reason. Medicare doesn't cover them. It would cost the government a fortune, considering two-thirds of Americans over 60 have some kind of hearing loss. And then there's this. Cost usually includes the services of an audiologist for fitting and maintenance. Audiologists use tones like these to measure a patient's hearing loss. I made this recording at one of the biggest hearing clinics in the country, Massachusetts Eye and Ear. Inside a soundproof booth, an audiologist pumped these tones into my ears and then asked me to make out the words in a recording that simulated conversation in a crowded room.
A streak of color ran down the left edge. It was done before the boy could see it.
My ears were healthy, but if I needed hearing aids, the audiologist would use this test to adjust the settings.
In general, I don't think they're very accessible to everyday average people.
Kevin Frank is director of audiology at Mass Eye and Ear.
Very few people who have hearing loss do something about that hearing loss. But also working within a clinic, you can see how there are many barriers that are put up that make it difficult for people to get the hearing care that they need.
That's no secret in the industry. A 2017 survey by the Hearing Health Foundation found that 40% of the people they asked had no hearing aid coverage through health insurance. And the vast majority believed the government should change the law to create something called
over-the-counter hearing aids.
That's Senator Elizabeth Warren. Last year in a committee hearing, she announced a bipartisan bill that would create a new class of affordable hearing aids that people could buy at the drugstore.
If hearing loss seems like a boring problem, I want you to think about what it means to be unable to participate in a meaningful conversation with another person, unable to talk on the telephone or to hear a television or radio. People with hearing loss are more likely to experience social isolation. They're even more likely to fall, which is the leading cause of death for people over the age of 65.
Warren's argument was persuasive. The Over-the-Counter Hearing Aid Act of 2017 passed, and President Trump signed it.
I'm very excited about it.
Again, Kevin Frank at Mass Eye and Ear.
If the Over-the-Counter Hearing Aid Act reduces some of those barriers, cost, stigma, hassle, then maybe people will adopt them more.
The FDA now has 3 years to write the rules that will regulate over-the-counter hearing aids, but Frank says the technology is already here.
The industry calls them personal sound amplification products. It's no one would ever call them that in the wild.
What do you call them when you're not at work?
Hearables. Hearables is the word for kind of headphones that do more, headphones with benefits.
Frank has a few examples spread out across his desk. One of them is a tiny little thing called the Bean. It sells on Amazon for about $300.
And the Bean is described as a quiet sound amplifier, and that's what it does.
It looks like a little bean.
That's right. And you put it in your ear. But what it would do is make quiet sounds louder.
In other words, it's a hearing aid. But for now, the company that makes it, Edemotic, can't legally call it one and can't market the Bean to people with hearing loss. The new law will change that and create a new wave of customers for big headphone companies like Bose. It will also create new risk.
Is the best way to have an individual self-diagnose and self-treat?
Neil DeSarno is chief staff officer for the American Speech-Language Hearing Association. He says selling over-the-counter hearing aids could take the audiologist out of the equation.
Hearing loss is a medical condition, and there are very few medical conditions that the government suggests that you totally manage on your own. No one asks you to manage your high blood pressure on your own.
And what if your hearing loss is a result of something serious, like a tumor or a virus? How would you know if all you did was buy a hearing aid at CVS? Supporters of the law say better access is worth the risk. Violist Betty Hauk still dabbles in music, even though hearing loss forced her to retire early. Hauk's $5,000 hearing aids are 4 years old, and soon they'll have to be replaced.
It's a source of anxiety because I have several things that need replacing, including my car, my DAC, and my hearing aids. And I think there are a couple of other things, and they're all coming together at the same time. And it's a little panicky about the money.
And that's something that millions of Americans can hear loud and clear. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.